Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Sarah Lazenby from Oxford, a group called Trident Plowshares. And she's part of something called the Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, and worried the BBC haven't been reporting the massive moves being made at the United Nations. And then something new called the Bronzefield Bulletin. It's our correspondent Sabine McNeil, who's a child abuse whistleblower. She's writing to us from jail at HMP Bronzefield. Then Professor Alexander Azadgan from California. And actually, he's originally Iranian. And he's talking to us about, guess what? Yes, Trump throwing out the Iran nuclear deal. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Sarah Lazenby, and I belong to Trident Plowshares, which is a non-violent direct action organisation that focuses on getting rid of Britain's nuclear weapons.
Non-violent direct action. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
It means that we don't just write letters to MPs and things, just as well, actually. It means we don't just write letters. We take our action and use our bodies to express our negative feelings about nuclear weapons and blockade various parts of Britain, such as the Faslane base for submarines in Scotland and Coolport, and also the nuclear transport convoy. They do a particularly good job on that in Stirling. And also down at Devonport, because there's where they do all the repairing of the nuclear weapons.
Could you take us through the various sites in the British Isles which Trident Plowshares focuses on?
There are a number of sites in the British Isles which are used to maintain our nuclear deterrent. And I won't say that word deterrent again, because it isn't. It's an aggressive monster. It consists of the very big submarines. In fact, if you took all the innards out, you could put 440 double-decker buses inside one of our submarines. And we have four of them. They operate at very great depths at the bottom of the North Atlantic. And the idea is that they're not detectable by Russia or anyone else. This is going to run out of reality moderately soon, partly because of underwater drones. And I can't remember the other reason, but it isn't going to be as secure in the future. So why spend £205 million over 20 years to replace four submarines?
Now, an underwater drone doesn't cost as much as a Trident nuclear submarine, and all it has to do is sort of follow a Trident submarine, and then that actually makes the submarine effectively useless.
Pretty well, yes. It isn't quite as simple as that, because I thought, when I first heard about underwater drones, I thought, oh yes, how exciting, you know, go and bop them one down in the depths. It's not at all. The underwater drones operate at the very surface. They don't operate very deeply. And I hope I've got this right, but I went to a whole conference on this. So there are future problems. That's all I can say, and other people could tell you more. However, we have these submarines, and when they're at home, they're at Faslane, which is due west of Glasgow on the Clyde estuary. And then they have nearby a special place called Coolport, which is, they have very, very deep bunkers that have been dug into the rock to safeguard the warheads while they're waiting to be loaded onto the submarine.
Okay, so that sounds a bit James Bond, you know, the idea the submarine
very
goes right into the side of a mountain or something.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. And the Scots were furious because it's a very beautiful bit of land there. So they dug away a lot. And if you go to the opposite side of Loch Long, which is what the Coolport dock is on, they look like bungalows, the heads of these silos or the heads of these these deep, secure chambers. Anyhow, that's where they keep the warheads until they load them onto the submarine. Just to try and pretend they're not doing it, they do it under a secure sort of roof that sticks out so you can't see it from the air. Everybody knows they go there, so I mean, it's, you know, they know when they go there, they see them going past on the way back and so on.
So are there any other bases around Britain where these nuclear weapons are?
There's no other base where they actually go, I believe, although I think Portsmouth they could go. They're pretty big. They're bigger than previous submarines we've had, although they're not as large as the American ones.
So they're the naval deterrent. What about nuclear bombs that can be, say, dropped from a plane or a cruise missile?
Well, we don't have any in Britain at the moment. We used to have an American base in East Anglia. Lake and Heath used to hold free-fall bombs for the Americans. But it wasn't the same as they are in Europe. When they are sort of NATO connected. I don't think perhaps they were. Anyhow, they've gone. We were just going to do a very big demonstration there of some sort when we found they've been taken home.
Do you believe America. Them? I mean, do you believe them when the military tell us that they've disappeared? Because,
oh,
I mean,
no, that was open knowledge. I don't, you know, that was sort of announced by the Americans, as far as I remember. I don't remember there being any secrecy about that.
Well, let's hope that they're telling the truth on that one, because there are quite a lot of powers around the world, aren't there, that have started to get nuclear weapons. I mean, we talk about India and Pakistan. We've also got Israel on top of the original nuclear powers, which is Russia, China, the United States, Britain, France. I mean, maybe you could... Do you know what other countries have got nuclear weapons?
No, I haven't heard that any more except North Korea have got them. And, of course, even Israel sometimes pretends it hasn't. But that's Israel for you. No, there are 9 countries, as far as we know, having nuclear. But in addition to that, America is very generous and gives NATO countries nuclear weapons, free-fall ones from aeroplanes, and they train the Belgian, Dutch, German, and French. German.
Italians?
No, I don't think they have it in. Greece gave up, and I think they have them in Turkey, but I'm not absolutely sure that they are. The ones I know are the ones I've mentioned. And all those pilots are specially trained to handle and load and offload, presumably, nuclear warheads. But they can only do it with the permission of the Americans.
Over the years, there's been all sorts of attempts to stop this. I mean, starting really with the Aldermaston marches and also, you know, British people saying, we don't want this nuclear bomb. In fact, it was used in the first instance in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in very controversial circumstances. Even military people saying that there was no need to use nuclear weapons at that point. I just wonder if you can bring us up to date with various attempts around the world to stop the rise and the proliferation of nuclear weapons and possibly even ban them altogether. Yeah.
There they are, quietly sitting on the bottom of the North Atlantic, doing nothing in particular, and causing no trouble. But the warheads are transported over land in big nuclear convoys. They go from... Aldermaston has two parts, the sort of research and development part at Aldermaston, and then it has another bit called Burfield. At Burfield, they do the final development of the high explosives and that sort of thing and put it together in such a way, not that it could explode like a big atomic bomb, but that it could be very dangerous. I'll come to that. So every so often, about 6 times a year, well, I think it's more often because they go on different routes. But where I live in Oxford, they come up the A34 about 6 times a year, this convoy, either taking them up to Coolport, the newly refreshed, perfectly lovely, nice, ready-to-go warheads, or they bring down the ones that have got tired, i.e. their tritium gas has leaked out of them, so they have to come down to be given more help. Anyhow, these are dangerous. The MOD originally said, oh, no, they're not dangerous at all, because they're specially designed so that if you hit them, nothing will happen. And then they came back later, I think another year later, and they said, ah, but if there's a shunt accident, it's different, and they would release plutonium. A very, very powerfully dangerous radioactive cloud or plume could be come out of these warheads, and because we live downwind from the prevailing wind, it could more than likely come across Oxford. So you've got a situation in which these trundle up and down, putting us all at risk, and it's on a road that has the highest accident level in the country, including a lot of jackknife accidents.
Some people will say this is a price we have to pay, Sarah, in order to keep the deterrent.
But you've got a situation in which you have weapons which are so lethal that if you were to use them, if you were to bop more than one or two, you would have an intolerable situation. The medical services would be completely and utterly unable to cope. The Red Cross has said so, International Red Cross. And you'd get nuclear winter. And after that, nobody would survive in the Northern Hemisphere because you couldn't grow crops for up to 10 years.
Okay, just take us through that whole scenario of a nuclear winter. What would it actually mean if there was some sort of limited nuclear exchange?
Well, what I understand that when you explode these bombs, they create so much radioactive dust that, like Krakatoa, the big volcano that erupted in the 19th century, they had a winter from that, from the dust, but it wasn't radioactive. So obviously the radioactivity of it will change how it will play out. But whatever it does, it'll put too much dust into the air and block out the sun. When the sun's blocked out, the crops will fail, and it's no possibility of going there. We wouldn't survive. It would be starvation, famine, first of all, I suppose, and then starvation, and then death, all over the Northern Hemisphere.
Some people say that nuclear weapons have kept the peace, but then we are in a situation now in the Middle East with tension ramping up all the time between Iran and nuclear-armed Israel. And if anything was to happen there, it would be inevitable, really, that the Russians in Syria would get involved with fighting the Americans, both nuclear-armed states. If that was to happen, then almost certainly the Chinese would come in on the Russian side, and you could end up with quite a major conflagration. I just wondered, do you think enough is being done to stop that sort of thing happening?
At a level, it slightly depends on the size of the nuclear weapons, and bigger ones would be worse. There aren't that many small ones, except I think in India, Pakistan, where they might have to actually fire about 100 to get a really bad result.
What is being done to try and limit the spread of nuclear weapons,
well,
the proliferation?
I think the most important thing that's being done is about 4 years ago, an organisation called the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons was set up with strong links in Australia and Norway. And they set themselves up to pursue getting a treaty that would ban, that would prohibit nuclear weapons, just exactly in the same way that chemical and biological weapons have been banned, and, of course, landmines and so on.
Well, you say that, but I mean, we've heard recently about this business in Salisbury with the Skripals and Novichok, allegedly, and we still have chemical weapons. There's a place called Porton Down. I was amazed, actually,
that
we're supposed to be part of some group which is of international treaty which has banned chemical weapons, and yet we keep hearing that actually they do have these chemical weapons.
You're allowed to have them. Because they're all part of scientific development, I think. I believe you're allowed to have them, but you're not allowed to use them. That's the issue. But I think one is sidetracked by that, because if you look at what was happening in the First World War, which shook people rigid about the dreadful things they did with mustard gas and so on. And that's why they came to these new treatises as time went by. Chemical ones, biological ones came later. Then you begin to think, why the heck do we have nuclear weapons when if you actually go for it at all enthusiastically, you will have a complete and total disaster? And isn't it better not to have them? And in fact, this treaty gives the nuclear weapon states, if they deign to join, they give them time to sort of disengage their nuclear weapons and get rid of them. And of course, getting rid of nuclear weapons is no small task. They're impossible to store safely anywhere. And I'm sure you've been aware of all the different places, all the councils that have been bribed to allow in Cumbria, for example, to allow nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, to be stored there. And then it's been undone. It has, because it's not safe.
But what about attempts to ban nuclear weapons across the world? How's it all going?
The ban? Well, first of all, they started up like this. They had a conference for all the representatives of all the states in Norway, in Oslo. The next one was in Cancun, in Mexico. And finally, in December 2016, the enthusiasm of the Austrians, they had a big conference there. And then it was decided that they were ready to ask the United Nations if they could draft a treaty and put it into action. So the following June, they had 2 weeks, and at least, and I think it may have been more the first time, 122 states went to New York to work on this draft. And then they came back on the 7th of July. And then they said, well, okay, here is a draft that we can all accept. And everyone agreed to it except Holland and one other country that abstained. The representative from Holland, of course, is a NATO country at the bidding of the United States to hold nuclear weapons. But the people in Holland had been so insistent that one representative from Holland had gone, but of course they didn't vote. They voted again. So we started encouraging the BBC to do coverage of this in that April, May period. And we did this, a few of us, not that many, but three people were dressed up as town criers, and we had a loudspeaker, and we had lots and lots of leaflets. We gave them out to the BBC staff as they went to lunch and came back from lunch. A lot of them, at least a third, took the leaflet, and at least a third of those must have actually fed them or shown a friend or a neighbour. It was not that the BBC didn't know what was going on. They knew very well. And at that point, I wrote to their complaints department about the absence of any coverage. And I got an email back, and it said, we acknowledge that we haven't broadcast anything about this. And they didn't say, oh, but it's on our website. It was posted on the website, which is one of their devices. And there never was any more. There was no more coverage by the media, and none in the broadsheets. And if you ask anybody around, just anybody you meet, did you hear about it? And the answer is no. Not until the Nobel Peace Prize. And then there was a slightly different situation because the straight, normal UK BBC mentioned it. But when they mentioned it, they didn't put in the context. They didn't say how many countries were involved or anything to show you that this had been developed, that it really was a United Nations treaty. None of that came out at all. They just talked about the two very fascinating women, one young, blonde, and Norwegian, and the other an 85-year-old who was actually And they've said nothing since. Now, if this, because this treaty will become international law, it has to have the support of enough countries, and those that support it and agree must get it ratified with their government. So far, I haven't heard very recently, but so far, 57 states have signed that they are keen to ratify, and 7, I think, have ratified.
Now, you talk about international law, but surely there's really only one international law these days. That's the law of the jungle.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, even more so with a loony lion in charge of the US, and the US still believing that it's in charge of the world. And I mean, you know, all to do with this war atmosphere, the Pilger film, which I imagine you did watch, John Pilger's film about the next war will be China. And then he showed all the bases, the American bases, surrounding the southern parts of China and on Japan, all of them ready to fire on China because they believe that's in their interest.
Now, they're also surrounding Iran. Do you ever wonder whether there's any point in carrying on in your campaign? It does seem like, particularly the United States, is actually gearing up for a war. It's like, actually, many dying empires do this kind of thing, as it looks like that they're sliding off the world scene. They're becoming less powerful. It's time to use all the weapons we've built up over the years.
Being hopelessly optimistic, I think we've got to a place with this treaty, which will not go away that easily. And, I mean, I am despondent because I am very despondent about the fact that the BBC chose to make a D notice on this subject when I understood D notices were only for the security of the state being at risk.
Well, how do you know there was a D notice then? Have you any evidence for that?
Because if you put two and two together, they either made the most frightful bungle of not getting it right and not publishing anything, or they were told not to.
So here's your chance to say what you think the BBC should be saying about it. What do you think they should say?
Well, they should have started off and early last summer and explained what was happening, what the states were doing, and then, by all means, explaining what this government's view is, and then the public can take their pick about it, because the government is particularly stupid on this one, because they've always said they were keen on multilateral disarmament. Well, the treaty is multilateral disarmament. It would, encourage that everybody disarm. And it's partly a response to the lack of action on the non-proliferation treaty, which has been going since, I think, 1958. And in that, about 20 years ago, they had an Article 6, and everybody signed. Every single state's party said yes, they would do this. And all the nuclear weapon states agreed in that without too much delay, they would get rid of their nuclear weapons. And the non-nuclear weapon states agreed to this because they were going to benefit by being given the scientific information about how to make nuclear power stations. And that's what that deal was about. Well, the nuclear weapon states have been sort of exceptionally inactive. They haven't done it at all. What they've done, they will say, if you ask them, they would say, oh, well, we used to have 100 warheads, so we've now got 43. That's much better. That's disarmament. And, of course, you know and I know that 6 warheads, or even 3, might be things that terminated life, along with other nuclear weapons countries.
Sarah, where is a good place to follow this? Obviously, we can't necessarily rely on the BBC.
No, you can't.
Whereabouts online can we find information about all this?
During the time of the Nobel Peace Prize, Stephen Secker did one of his hard talk programs, I was so bowled over by this because he interviewed both Beatrice Finn and this woman, the Japanese woman, Sekisiko Thurlow. And he did such a brilliant interview with them, and it was patently obvious he actually thought what their organisation did was totally brilliant. And it was totally obvious, this. Now, I heard it in the middle of the night on World Service in Britain. I don't know if it was ever broadcast on World Service in the daytime, the DAB radios, but then a video of it went out with the BBC World Service TV, where countries buy into having it. So it went all over the world. So it's all right to have it all over the world, as long as the Brits don't hear about it.
Just to say, the actual website for the organisation, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, is at www.icanw.org. That's www.icanw.org. So, Sarah Lazenby from Trident Ploughshares, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We're doing a series of letters from prison, and the person writing those letters is Sabine McNeil. She's been putting forward evidence in London, she says, of serious abuse of children. And because she refuses to stop making that evidence public, the courts have decided that she's the one who should go to jail. So here's a latest missive from her in jail. Wednesday, the 18th of April, 2018. Sabine McNeil, A8115EC. Writing is my therapy here, and to write to you is special. Today's message can be short. Due to the removal of my Nordic walking sticks without replacement, my hip joint has reacted. The level of pain caused when it was dislocated 45 years ago, permanent and seriously aggravated when standing or walking. I shall have to drag myself to the physiotherapist, as wheelchairs cannot be organised. I can only hope that I won't miss my two-hour video link with my legal team, given the rules staff operate by. I get food and water thanks to kind co-prisoners. Getting an official carer takes at least 1 to 2 weeks. All that because we have a modern Savile in our midst, but protected not only by the BBC. Above all, he and his named abusers are protected by the police. The fact that police protection includes the Church of England is the reason for my being here. In my naivety, I'd thought that safeguarding means protecting children. Now it means protecting abusers by fitting up and hounding defenders of children's rights. Jake Clark, who'd been sectioned for 3 months and forcefully medicated for 7 months, has just been arrested. He was my most loyal visitor. Delusional disorder, they say. Public protection and HMP safeguarding has resulted in me becoming a, in quotes, potential person posing a risk to children, close quotes, says the PPRC. Because of my behaviour and or conduct in prison, which consisted in receiving a summary of the case as part of a major envelope in my defence from Peter Oakes. And that was the latest message. We'll be doing them almost weekly, or every other week at least, when we get them, from Sabine McNeil, who's in a jail in Middlesex because of giving evidence about child abuse that she believes is still going on, and that the police are working more with the abusers than with those who are trying to expose them.
My name is Alexander Azadgan. I'm a senior geopolitical analyst with Press TV, Iran Press TV, on a regular basis. I am also the editor-at-large for ImperiaNews.com. I'm also a college professor here in Southern California.
And what do you make of the JCPOA? pulling out
of it? I think I have a different approach to this thing. I see the silver lining in this for Iran. I think this was really the best thing that could happen to Iran, as painful as it may be in the next few weeks and months to come. It has unified the Iranian people, even the liberals who were against any nuclear, even peaceful nuclear activity. They are on board with the other conservative colleagues in Iran. And every time you have an external, even, you know, a verbal match against Iran, the Iranians tend to unify. So exiting out of JCPOA has isolated Washington. It's getting Iran a little bit closer to its European counterparts, and particularly three countries that are signatories to the JCPOA, that being the UK, France, and Germany. Germany is becoming closer to Russia. We heard of the Nord Stream pipeline that's happening, taking place between Vyborg and a city in the northeast, the part of Germany, Greifswald, I believe. And so we are seeing all sorts of indication that Washington is being isolated, and I think this is good for global security and peace.
Tell us about this Nord Stream. Nord Stream pipeline. What's the geopolitical implications of that?
The geopolitical implications in that, very shortly, is that Ukraine may be sidelined. It's quite possible that the Germans may actually sacrifice Ukraine, and that the Ukrainians would learn a lesson that they would be sacrificed if they come on, you know, under the these mechanisms like the WTO or all these globalist mechanisms. So they're learning the lessons the hard way. We are hoping that the Ukrainian people would learn their lesson and not want to deviate from their traditional allies, which they also have a lot of problems with the Russian allies.
Okay, so the idea is that this pipeline is going from Russia around the north of Ukraine in towards Germany.
Well, there's the one that is more publicized is that it goes from this city, Vyborg, which is north of St. Petersburg in the outer western part of Russia. It goes through southern Finland on land. Then it literally goes under the Baltic Sea into Greifswald in Germany. But there's other proposals. The Germans don't want to alienate the Ukrainians that much. So it may go through Ukraine, which would actually bring Russia and Ukraine closer together to a point of collaboration, which would be beneficial to both of those countries. Because as you are aware, the West, and particularly Washington, has been trying to create a huge wedge between Ukraine and Russia. And they have been successful. And there's a war going on, you know, in the Donetsk Republic. So this could actually bring everybody closer, and they could isolate Washington, as it should be under President Trump, who is the bully, he's belligerent, and he has no concept of anything. There's no concept of an international accord.
Yeah, Trump?
Read the 159 pages of JCPOA. Everyone should read this. Anyone who wants to pontificate on JCPOA has to go online, download the PDF file for the JCPOA. It's 159 pages exactly. And I don't believe Trump even has the attention span beyond an executive memo.
Now, what about the internal politics in the Middle East? Because many people are saying that this has created an opportunity for Israel to actually do something stupid and get a war started with Iran now.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe the Israelis are that stupid, although I would hope they would be. The Israelis and the Iranians are going to continue their proxy wars in Syria. If you recall from yesterday, literally a few minutes or a few hours after Trump's announcement, they threw two bombs or two missiles, I'm not sure, against the Iranian positions in Syria. And the Syrian air defense took out the S-220. We have the S-220, we have the S-200. The most advanced version is the S-400. The Syrians brought down both of those missiles with their air defense systems. And that was a great victory in the sense that they're trying to contain Israel. And at the same time, they are trying to not exert too much energy. Anyone who's done martial arts knows the fact that minimum effort in defeating your enemy is the best way to go. Number two, never underestimate your enemy. So the Iranians have been playing their cards right. The West, and especially Israel, wants to goad Iranians into a war. So do the Saudis, but the Iranians are much smarter than that. So unfortunately, I hate to say this, Syria is going to continue to be the proxy the territory for all these countries fighting each other. U.S. against Russia, Saudi against Iran, Iran against Israel, and they're being destroyed, unfortunately. I hate to see this. At the same time, if Iran and Israel go to a war, which is highly unlikely, then we're going to end up paying $100 a barrel for oil. And that's going to create an inflationary effect in the United States and across the globe, which would make the consumers very restless, which would take their support away from Mr. Trump. I mean, the petroleum is at an all-time high since 2014. It's $70 a barrel, or as of a few days ago. So I don't forecast any wars between Israel and Iran. I don't forecast any wars between the United States and Iran. I am concerned about a second Iran-Iraq war. As you recall, these two nations were supposed to, you know, neutralize each other in the 80s. That was the plan of the Israelis. That was the plan of everybody. This time they want to try to get Iran and Saudi Arabia, two Muslim nations, to neutralize each other.
Okay.
The Iranians have been very shrewd in that area. Foreign minister has been very conciliatory with their Saudi counterparts. But I'm afraid the Saudis are relying too much on their hubris and arrogance, especially under Mr. Mohammed bin Salman. And so they're getting way too arrogant, and they may actually get stupid and do something.
Now, what about the situation for Donald Trump? Because a month or so ago, his lawyer was raided by the FBI, by the feds, the same people who are trying to prosecute him over the Russiagate case. Right. It does look as if the law enforcement authorities, the FBI, are almost at war with Trump. And now they've got all those cards up their sleeve. That is to say, all the private communications between Trump and his lawyer.
Mm-hmm. And that lawyer's name is Michael Cohen. Cohen, so we know who really put him in that place. And he has said that if he's threatened, he's going to leak stuff. This is something that Trump is petrified of, disloyalty. We know this, as a matter of fact, in his personality. He likes loyalty. He appreciates loyalty. He rewards loyalty.
But I mean, hasn't he opened himself up to blackmail, really?
Absolutely. It's my theory that he has opened himself up to blackmail by the neocons. The neocons are blackmailing him now. That's why you got these neocons like John Bolton or Mike Pompeo in very high places of power. So, and they have a, believe me, this man has so many skeletons in his closet. And I'm not just talking about his sexual escapades. All sorts of other deals, financial impropriety, connections to the Russian mafia. Not the Russian government, Russian mafia. And he does. And so they will use that against him. And they say, if you don't put neocons in places of power, if you don't implement neocon policies, which the exit out of JCPOA is exactly what that is,
now,
then we're going to literally impeach you.
Now, now Michael Cohen seems to be being under investigation himself. We've seen the appearance of Rudy Giuliani as a potential lawyer now for Donald Trump. Who is this guy? What's his past?
Rudy Giuliani is a very, very nasty lawyer. He was the mayor of New York for quite a few years. He tore up New York. I mean, the people in New York are very liberal, very leftist. He tore that town down when it comes to politics. He regularly lectures in front of a terrorist group in Paris. They're called MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization. These are people who killed Americans in Iran before the revolution. And because they have a very strong lobby, they've been taken out of the terrorist list. Rudy Giuliani had a hand in that. John Bolton, the new NSA, National Security, had a hand in that. So he's not very young. He's getting higher in his age. He's getting up there. Nevertheless, if he does become a counsel for Donald Trump, and he was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump, and he was actually running for office when Donald Trump was running, then we are looking at a situation where Donald Trump is going to be bolstered. Having said that, most people are afraid of legal lawsuits, especially at the presidential level. Donald Trump is an expert, and he actually goads people into suing him so he can sue them back. So this is a shameless man, and he has shameless people around him, like Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani, let me just put it, since you asked that question, let me just put it to you very briefly. This guy's only asset was 9/11. That was his political sort of cash cow. And so that's how he really ran the town after he was still the mayor of that town, before Bloomberg got in. But on the same token, we have to be fair and balanced. He really was tough on the mafia in New York. He did incredible renovation and closing down the ghettos, improving the ghetto situation in New York. At the same time, at the federal or national level, he's definitely going to be dangerous. He is instrumental in regime change in Iran. should not be underestimated. And these people get, you know, thousands of dollars for their speaking fees when they come to. By the way, the MKO is based in Paris. Why the Iranians have not negotiated or threatened Paris to expel these people is beyond me. It's absolutely beyond me. They're hosting a group of terrorists, and these are very well funded. They are have very strong lobbies at the EU in Brussels and also in Washington, but they are a proven terrorist group. They were also instrumental, MKO or all, they also go by MEK, instrumental in suppressing the Iranian, the Iraqi people, because they decided to side with Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. They're political opportunists, and they put down the Kurdish rebellion after the 1990 war. They put down the Shia rebellion and after the 1990 war. And they're extremely nasty people.
Now,
and
okay, these sorts of terrorists like MKO, MEK, where do they get their funding from? Who is pulling their strings?
The funding comes from, part of it comes from EU. A big chunk of it comes from Washington. And now, of course, if they're in France, I'm sure the French are supporting them. The French are using them as a leverage to negotiate with the Iranians. And the Iranians, I'm afraid, are falling for it. That should be one of the prerequisites. When Trump was on national air yesterday, or international air, accusing Iran of terrorism, it was, we all know the hypocrisy of Washington, but this was at the disgusting level, because they are supporting the nastiest the terrorists, in this case MEK or MKO.
Now, give us an example of what have MKO and MEK actually been up to over the years, you know, and how long have they been active in Iran?
They've been acting since the 1960s in Iran. They were instrumental in, you know, overthrowing the Shah. They were actually with the revolution in the beginning, but very rapidly, because they wanted to take power and put their guy in power. His name was Masoud Rajavi. He got actually killed in Iraq. They had a military base in Iraq during Saddam Hussein war. It was called Ashraf military base, not too long from Baghdad. That totally got liquidified. I mean, they destroyed it. Iraq is destroyed. The Iranians destroyed it. A lot of those fighters there are all over Europe, especially in Sweden, Germany, and now France. These people started in the 60s. They started legitimately, even though they called themselves Islamic Marxists. And they fought against the Shah. They killed Americans. That's on record. But you know, shift forward 40, 50 years into the future, their lobby is so strong in Washington that they somehow managed to take themselves out of the terrorist watch list or terrorist group or designated terrorist organization. And they have very strong lobbies in Washington. One of them is called the Iran Project, in which they have very strong influence over neocons like John McCain. He's the senior senator in Arizona. And then Lindsey Graham from North Carolina, these super neocon pro-Israel, pro-Zionist senators, and they're openly in league with the MKO.
What about the immediate problems after the revolution? And you say that MKO, MEK were actually involved at the time of the revolution, because I know that there were thousands of terrorist attacks in Iran. There was also the horrific attack which killed members of the cabinet and the president not long after the revolution. Was MKO and MEK involved in those?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's proven. I mean, they killed, they were involved in the killing of a prime minister and a president very early in 1982, if I'm correct, at the prime ministerial residence in close to the Iranian, the former Iranian parliament location. They were and involved all the way down to the future. They, by the way, they cooperate very closely with Mossad. Mossad actually does the planning, MKO does the implementation. They were instrumental in murdering Iranian nuclear scientists. Very, very lately. Also, they were responsible and took credit for taking out Sayyad Shirazi, a high-ranking Iranian general who was also murdered by these people way after the end of Iran-Iraq war. So this is a very, very nasty group who's been active in terrorist operations during the Shah time and after Shah was toppled, when they couldn't get in power, when the Ayatollahs took over and they edged these Islamic Marxists out of power. And they're neither Islamic nor are they Marxist or communist or socialist. They are just a very shrewd, opportunistic group of traitors to their own homeland, which happens to be Iran. Now, a lot of them capitulated after United States attack and occupation, invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003. Many of the rank and file capitulated to the West. Many of them actually have been repatriated back to Iran. And they're very, very vocal all over YouTube, describing how evil this organization was. Masood Rajavi, who was the head of that organization, was a disgustingly corrupt man having orgies in pools in the Ashraf military base. This has been well documented. This is a very evil man. His wife, Maryam Rajavi, who runs MKO right now in Paris, was actually ordered, Tony, he was ordered to divorce her husband and marry Rajavi. This is not just a political organization. It's also a very dangerous cult. The West has defined it as a cult, not just a political covert organization. And by the way, they have excellent organizational skills, which made them very, very dangerous. But their power is corroding. Even when they have, you know, morons like John Bolton or Rudy Giuliani at these huge conferences, which is, by the way, you can watch it on the YouTube. They don't have enough people to support them. So they actually bring people from Bulgaria and Eastern Europe. They drive them to buses to Paris in order to make their population look bigger in propaganda videos that they have.
Now let's have another look at Syria and the Kurds, particularly because these people have been in need of somewhere to live. I mean, it's almost like a kind of homeless group for many, many years. And many people are saying that actually, even now, with Syria in the situation it is, the Turks, for example, are not content and they're not happy, neither are the Syrians, to give the Kurds their own homeland, because they believe that they would probably actually be controlled almost like puppets by the Americans. Now, is there any hope, do you think, for the Kurds to actually get a homeland out of all this? Because obviously quite a lot of land has been sort of liberated in northern Syria, which naturally, finally, maybe the Kurds will get somewhere, but no one seems to want it because they believe that the Kurds are really controlled from elsewhere and from outside, and they don't want an outside power in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. And the Kurds, look, before I answer that question, the Kurds have very strong lobbies. The majority of them in Europe live in Germany and Sweden. They have very strong lobbies at the political level and also at the grassroots level in the streets of big cities in Europe. So there is a natural tendency for a European sympathy. It's never going to happen as much as Washington wants it. Washington is actually supporting the Kurdish separatists, SDF, and all these other groups. It's never going to happen because this is actually going to bring very strange bedfellows together: Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. Now, if we go with the map of Bernard Lewis, a 101-year-old Middle East expert and a scholar out of Princeton University, he has a very famous map that's been leaked all over the internet. If that, God forbid, if that ever happens, and that's a neocon plan, by the way, to completely draw a new map in the Middle East. If that happens, then the Kurds are going to have their homeland. What makes the Kurds dangerous is that in the area that they claim as their homeland is very, very rich in oil and natural gas. And that adds to the complexity of the geopolitics of energy in that region.
Are you saying it's that their claim to that land is fake?
I cannot say that, because the Kurds were known as the ancient, I mean, these people's old identity was they were the Medians. The Medians were in, how can I put it, in alliance with the Persians. As a matter of fact, the first name for the Persian Empire was called the Medo-Persian Empire. The Persians really needed these people in order to grow. And then later they kind of sort of just call it the Persian Empire. No, they historically lived in all those lands, in eastern and northern Syria, in northern Iraq, in the entire eastern Turkey, and in the northwest and western Iran. And there is no one Kurdish identity. There's a Syrian Kurdish identity. There's a Turkish Kurdish identity, and Iraqi identity, Kurdish identity, and the Iranian. Well, I mean,
but only that's only because they haven't had anywhere to live. They've had to live in other countries on the borderlands.
Except that it's more complicated than living in other countries, because that was their country. That is their land. You know, it's just that, you know, after the Skype PICO Accord, where the lines were driven by one or two star British generals, they drew all these, you know, lines in the sand and decided to create all these artificial countries. And now we see the effect of that, for example, in Iraq and in Syria. It's all coming apart. But it's not the same in Iran. The Kurdish are revered to be the most true Iranians by the Iranians, by the Persians, which are 75% of the Iranians in Iran. You got the Azeri Turks, you got the Baluchis, you got the Turkmens in Iran. So the Persians consider the Turks to be the most Iranian, the most pure Iranians, mostly because of the topography of where they live, very mountainous, not too many intermarriages. They look, believe it or not, very Indo-European because they are believed to be the most, this is very controversial. I hope your audience understands this. They are branded and they claim to be the most the distinct group of all Indo-Iranian or Indo-Aryans. But this is not obviously what, you know, it's very different than what the Nazis were propagating. They mixed Nordic with Aryan, unfortunately. But so in Iran, they are much more supported than, for example, in countries where the language is totally different, such as Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, where the language is Arabic. The Kurdish language actually very similar to Persian. I understand them when they talk. You have to pay attention closely, but it's like the difference between the German, the dialect that's spoken in Germany versus the German dialect that's spoken in Switzerland. So it's very complicated. There's no one Kurdish nation, although you're right, there's a tendency for many of these people to want to become one, but there are tremendous differences.
What about the threat that Netanyahu has made this week against the life of President Assad, saying that if you allow Iranian troops into your country, we're going to kill you?
Yeah, I know. The man is belligerent. But let's not forget, this man was taken to the police custody not too long ago. He actually had an anxiety attack, a panic attack. The Israelis' propaganda advertised that as a heart condition. The man drinks like a fish. He's got all sorts of issues. The Israeli left hates him. We have to rely on our Israeli colleague on the liberal side. He's extremely unpopular in his country, but he plays the fear card.
Now, Netanyahu is not unpopular in Israel. Surely he's won all the most last 10, actually no, 20 years of elections.
Because of coalition government setup, because the left doesn't have coalition. So without, I mean, if you just go by the Likud party, there's no way he could win. He's a master in coalition building, and that's how he has won. Also, you know, the race, the aggression part of him. You have to understand, when societies feel threatened, psychology tells us, and social psychology tells us, that when societies are threatened, they resort to the paternalistic male model. And that really works in the Middle East because they constantly are at war with each other. Be it in Syria, Iran, or Israel, definitely in Saudi Arabia, an extremely misogynistic and paternalistic culture. So that was his sociological card. But the Iranians are not really helping this guy to, you know, be overthrown from his office. Putting death to Israel on your missiles is not exactly going to help you, you know, in your media war. But yeah, they got a personal grudge with President Bashar al-Assad. He cannot stand, Netanyahu cannot stand that it's been this long, it's been going on since 2011, the war against Syria, going into its eighth year, and that Bashar al-Assad has not been overthrown. And he will not be overthrown because the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are firmly behind him. So all these threats are for psychological purposes.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sarah Lazenby from Trident Ploughshares in Oxford. Also to Professor Alexander Azadgan from California. And I suppose vicariously, Sabine McNeil, who's been writing letters in to the studio, which we've been reading out, the Bromsfield Bulletin. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain through the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Centenario. Australian, and number 3 on the DJ's choice. And most of the tracks in the charts are upbeat house records, and it's no real surprise because, as we know, Amsterdam is house nation of the world.